Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast. Masterpiece Studio is brought to you by Viking Cruises, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at vrc.com. I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. Another season of Grantchester is done and dusted, and it's been a dramatic and interesting few months for nearly everyone in the village. In Grantchester, the romances are as volatile as the murder mysteries. This season, as lead writer Daisy Coulam told us,
I don't think people expected this show to go to sexy places.
Some romances ended, others were renewed, and, for Mrs. McGuire at least, wedding bells rang.
To love is to live. And we must do so with all our heart, and with all our soul, and with all our might. If you would raise your glasses to Mrs. M. and Jack.
Mrs. C.
To Mrs. C. and Jack.
Mrs. C. and Jack.
And to love.
To love.
But not all of Grantchester's roller coaster relationships were wrapped up as neatly at the end of the season. Detective Inspector Geordie Keating dumped Margaret and tried to make his way back to Kathy. Leonard Finch abandoned Hillary and reignited a spark with Daniel. And the Reverend Sidney Chambers kept his faith but lost his Amanda.
Maybe people aren't ready for us to be honest. We should at least be honest with ourselves.
Daisy Coulam, Grantchester's lead writer and executive producer, returns to the podcast this week for a special conversation about the season that was. And we are joined again this week by writer and executive producer Daisy Coulam. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Season 2 dealt with some heavy issues of crime and punishment, while Season 3 dealt a lot with secrets and lies, particularly those we tell ourselves. Thematically, what did you set out to explore this year with the story?
Well, very quickly we found our theme. I think because of Sydney and Amanda's situation, their relationship, which basically cannot be, we very quickly sort of stumbled on the theme of love versus duty. It's a huge conflict for Sydney. He loves his job. He has a duty to the church, but he is in love with a woman. And it's the tension between love and duty that plays out through the series and for most of our characters, actually. So we've got Geordie struggling with his duty to his family and his love for another woman. And we have Leonard struggling with his, again, his duty to the church and his burgeoning kind of sexuality. It very quickly became clear that it worked for everyone, and it really infused the series with quite a lot of tension and conflict.
I mean, ultimately, Sidney does choose his priestly duty to the parish over a chance of personal happiness with Amanda.
Yeah.
I wanted this. I wanted it so much.
I let myself believe you when I knew all along.
I love you.
You love me? You love me. What about Grace?
Why is it so impossible for him to choose Amanda and seize this chance at happiness for himself?
It's really interesting. From the very beginning, we said that Sidney, in a sense, his whole wartime past, everything that's happened to him, everything that's informed him, he doesn't think he deserves happiness. This is the subtext of it for me, always has been, that he feels he's not good enough for Amanda, and the church is him and he is the church. He is a vicar and he loves that job, and it's who he is. It's not just a job for him. It's exactly who he is, and he can't turn his back because, yeah, he loves helping people. He loves that probably more than Amanda, and I think it's terribly sad, but who knows what will happen in Series 4.
When she finds Sydney's resignation letter still at home, Amanda realizes that she will always come second to the moral needs of the village, but she has to put herself and her child first. Mm-hmm. Was their love always doomed from the start?
In my head, it's always been doomed, but I love them when they're together, but there's always been that. I mean, from the very first scene where you see them in the very first episode, where they're sitting having a picnic, and she's already out of his reach. She's already engaged, and in a sense, they're each other's first loves, and sometimes first love doesn't work, sadly.
Was this always the end game that you envisioned for Sydney and Amanda? Or has that changed over the last 3 years of constructing these episodes?
It has changed, and it's sort of organic process when you're storylining. You know, things, you know, sometimes storylines will be known from the very beginning, and sometimes things kind of just flow, or actors will come up with ideas. And but I think it was inevitable. I think subconsciously we all knew it was going to be a sad ending.
And how difficult was it to write this breakup scene between Sydney and Amanda?
Again, this was a scene that went through quite a few drafts because it needed to be... It needed to sense the finality of it without being too kind of melodramatic. So at one point I had... And in fact, I think even in the final script, she was kind of swearing at him and getting angry. And then we realised, no, it's more about the sadness. It's about... Yeah, the inevitable sadness of it, and they play it so beautifully and quietly that it just, yeah, it's quite devastating actually.
Could this be the end for Amanda Hopkins on the show?
I hope not. I would hope not. I mean, I think in the sense that star-crossed lovers, they're always, you know, those people that your first loves always pop up again at some point, inevitably. Probably at the worst possible point when you're just about to get married or something. I would hope not because, well, I love Amanda and I also think Morven is just one of the classiest British actors around at the moment.
Some viewers have vilified Amanda as if she were to blame or that calling Sydney a selfish bastard was somehow undeserved. How do you respond to those reactions? Or in another way, why are some viewers so quick to blame her?
I don't know. I think I find it quite difficult, actually, when I read those kind of tweets. It's... Because sometimes I think it comes from a place where people are trying to protect Sydney from sadness or something, or they feel like, I worry sometimes it comes, this is probably, and I don't mean to put this on the people who write those tweets, but sometimes it feels quite misogynistic, maybe. I don't know, blaming the woman, I don't know. Or maybe they feel she was unsympathetic, I don't know. I find it very hard when people are mean about characters that I've sort of are in my head and I feel like I know them like my family. So I'm not quite sure. Yeah, they didn't. Some people didn't warm to her, but I think that was unfair, really. I think it's a generational thing too, because a lot of people on Twitter are obviously younger and therefore I have those kind of feelings. Whereas my mum and dad totally understand it. They're, you know, in their late 60s, 70s, and they understand it. It's, you know, it's a tricky situation and the social mores of those times. And, you know, I wonder if it's something to do with that as well.
Everyone's secrets came spilling out at the charity ball. And the love triangle between Geordie, Margaret and Kathy came to a head. Back when you were plotting this season, how early did you know that you'd drive a wedge between Geordie and Kath?
When we were storylining it, we had all these big secrets, and then we were just like, let's put them all in one episode. Let's do this. And let's really, from the beginning, really, we wanted Sydney and Geordie to be, not to be at odds, but to be each other's confidants. And through this series, rather than, you know, kind of falling apart, they're there for each other. So we were like, let's, you know, chuck everything at them in this one episode and see, and try and thematically play off that kind of duty versus love. That was quite fun. Also, I was in that episode.
Were you in that?
In the ball scene with my husband in a yellow dress, slightly like a plump chicken in the background. but it was such a long day that they filmed for like 8-9 hours or whatever, just in that one room. But quite fun to see it all come to life.
Were James's parents also in that scene?
They were. So they were standing. There's quite a good close up of those two. Actually, I'm quite glad there's no close ups of me, which I was actually quite glad about in the end. But James, they get a little. They're chatting to Geordie at one point. But apparently, well, I know James gets his dad in everything he does. He always puts his dad in there somewhere, and his mum was persuaded this time to be in it as well. So it was quite fun.
Geordie and Kath dance and make the first steps towards reconciling at Mrs. M, now Mrs. C's, wedding. I love the line, in the midst of the nappies and the laundry, I forgot it was you and me. Can they truly repair that rift, or will the underlying issues between them continue to plague them?
Thought you might like a drink.
Thank you.
I forgot, didn't I? In the midst of all the nappies and the laundry, I forgot it was you and me.
I never forgot, Geordie.
Well, we always sort of said that Geordie and Kathy, in a sense, are the true sort of 50s couple. They're not forward-thinking like Amanda. They're not kind of... They're very... In those days, I think people did, you know, some people had affairs, and then you just stayed married because that's what you did. And for me, I think whatever problems you throw at Geordie and Kathy, they'll stay together. I just think forever until, you know, there'll be an old couple kind of... slightly bickering, but always, and they do love each other. They do. I think, you know, long marriages, sometimes problems occur.
One of the most affecting storylines this season was Leonard's struggle, first his engagement to Hillary and then his suicide attempt. Where did the idea for Leonard trying to kill himself come from?
You see, this is a case of the storyline coming from the actor, actually. We were in, we must have been filming season two, and I was in the car with Al going to set. And he said, I really think that that Leonard would make a suicide attempt at some point. He said, I think he'd take a bunch of pills and just come down and announce that he'd taken a bunch of pills. And I was thinking, I kind of kept playing over that in my mind and going, he totally is the kind of character who would very quietly do something very drastic. And I kind of took that to Emma, the producer, and she thought it was a great idea. And so we kind of fitted it in, and it worked really well for Sydney because it works as a kind of push for him to go, the church, we're living by these rules of the church, and sometimes it damages people, and so we kind of used it as a catalyst for him to go off the rails, really.
Leonard and Danielle close out the season by kissing at the wedding reception, as Leonard acknowledges that the least they can do is be honest with themselves. Does this moment prove that these two are strong enough to overcome the professional and even legal obstacles in their way?
I think what basically they're going to have to do is live this secret kind of life, as you say in that quote, Leonard's basically saying, we'll be honest with each other. No one else can know about this, but we'll just kind of quietly live our lives. And I think there were quite a few people who did that in those times, that they were, of course there were gay people in the 50s. You just didn't hear about them because they weren't allowed to say it out loud. I'm pleased Leonard's got a moment of happiness, frankly, because he deserves it.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors. Masterpiece Studio is brought to you by Viking Cruises. See the world differently by exploring differently. Learn more at vrc.com. Masterpiece Studio is also brought to you by Farmers Insurance and their 88 years of experience, helping people so they can prepare for the unexpected. They know a thing or two because they've seen a thing or two. Find an experienced agent at farmers.com. You said in a panel discussion that you had, quote, made a strict rule that Sydney can have a crisis of self rather than a crisis of faith, unless you get to series three. Do you feel that the two merged this season, Sydney's twin crises, or are they one and the same, the crisis of self and the crisis of faith for a vicar?
Oh, well, for me, I still don't think that Sydney's had a crisis of faith in the sense that he hasn't renounced God. I think God will always be there for Sydney. This series, it's about his crisis of faith in the church, in the institution. And he's just seeing all around him. Mrs. M is struggling, trapped in a life she didn't choose because she has to remain married to this man because it's scandalous if you don't. And Leonard's trapped in a lie. He can't be with Amanda. Everyone around him is struggling with these institutional rules. And for me, God hasn't left his side and he's not left God's side. But he's really grappling with those kind of themes of rules and regulations.
My favorite reaction to the rather unexpectedly hot sex scenes this season on Grantchester came from @ChloeArmstrong1 on Twitter, who said, quote, I don't know why Grantchester is so horny all of a sudden, but I'm here for it.
I don't.
Were you Were you surprised by the shock over those scenes this season?
I was. Funny enough, I retweeted that one because it made me laugh. I don't think people expected this show to go to sexy places. And we were like, you know, we're going to shock people with these scenes. Although, yes, the sex scene with Geordie and Margaret was a little bit shocking for me as well, I must say. When I saw the rushes, I found it quite hard to look at. That's the thing with this show. We should push it to kind of dark and interesting and places, well, otherwise it becomes too soft and sweet, and I think that would be detrimental to the show.
The episode ends on Geordie's line, "It's the game, Sydney, it's the game," which is the same line at the end of Grantchester's first episode.
Let me set you up with a girl.
Buy me a pint and shut up.
Backgammon?
If we must.
Oh, it's the game, Sydney. It's the game.
There's a real sense of finality here. Could this be a series finale ultimately, or is there a sense that the show will be commissioned for a fourth go-around?
Well, it's really funny. We still don't know. We're waiting for news. But I always worry with these things, like series like Deadwood, which I absolutely adored, and then they found out they'd been cancelled, and it ended in a slightly odd place. And you thought, well, if they'd known they were going to be cancelled, you know, would they have wrapped it up neatly? So we always had in the back of our minds, just wrap it, you know, so that if I'm touching wood now, if worst came to worst and it didn't come back, you wouldn't feel like it wasn't complete in some way. So who knows? I would, season forward, that would be marvellous if we could. It's just get everyone in the same room, really. James is off being famous, James Norton, and Robson's off. He's doing an amazing new show, and he's doing his fishing and everything, and everyone is super busy. So it's a case of pulling them all back, but hopefully we can do it.
And with that line, did you try to signal that this could be an end if it is?
Yeah, I suppose so. I was thinking, you know, if worst case scenario, basically, I was thinking, would I be happy if this was the last scene of ever? I can safely say, you know, I feel like we've come full circle and we've still got our lovely friendship and they've got their dog, and, you know, it felt like a fitting ending. But hopefully not. Hopefully not.
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite scene from this season of Grantchester?
Ooh, I think one of my favourite scenes is Sydney comforting Leonard in his bedroom after the suicide attempt. I just think those two light up the screen when they're together, and it's just something quite tender about one man comforting another man, and just it was beautifully done. But I have so many favourite scenes. Mrs. M crying, Mrs. M getting married, just Kathy when she finds out about the affair, when she says, "You bought her a necklace and you bought me a food mixer." Just like, oh God, you're so good.
"You bought me a food mixer. You bought her a necklace. Do you love her?"
If this does, for some reason, end up being the end of Grantchester, what do you hope that viewers take away from the show and these characters?
I hope they take away that religion is something to be thought about, and it's something to explore rather than dismiss. Not that I'm actually not religious myself, but I feel quite strongly that it shouldn't be something that's laughed at. It should be something that's explored and is complex. But also I hope they enjoyed Sydney and Geordie and Amanda and Kathy and Leonard. I just hope they enjoyed those characters and got some kind of pleasure from them, really, because for me that's what it's all about, is those central characters and how much I love them, really.
And what's your typical writing process like on a given day?
It involves a lot of procrastination. But actually, weirdly, I think procrastination is part of the process. But I tend to be an early riser, coffee-driven, and lots of film soundtracks to listen to. That's what I seem to get my inspiration from. And then I'll just write about 8 or 9 pages a day, maybe, depending on the deadline or how little time I've left myself. But what's good about our team is that it's very much each draft will be a work in progress, and lots of people will throw ideas in. And I actually like it. I'm not one of those writers who doesn't take ideas very well. I much prefer it. The more ideas, the more kind of, you know, thoughts they can throw in, the richer it becomes, I think.
So what was the soundtrack for this year then? What were you listening to?
A bit of Frost Nixon. It's very good.
Oh.
What else? I listened to a lot of Thomas Newman and a lot of, so kind of The Help and American Beauty and stuff like that. Quite melancholy stuff, actually. But anything without words, basically. If there's any kind of singing, I get very distracted. So I need something with just some kind of classically music. But yeah, lots of stuff, lots of just, I find film soundtracks really, it makes you think more visually, I think, and makes you kind of think bigger rather than just being, you know, two-handers in a room.
Was there a specific television show that first ignited your passion for writing for television?
There was a show called, I don't know whether you had it there, it's called The Storyteller. It was a sort of Jim Henson,
yes.
Yeah, and it was written by Anthony Minghella, who obviously went on to direct The English Patient and things, but he grew up in the same, on the Isle of Wight, which is a small island off the coast of England, where I grew up. He grew up there too. And I remember thinking, somebody from where I live wrote this, and it's amazing. And it was so beautiful. The writing was so beautiful. It really inspired me. And we had it on, my sister and I had it on VHS. And we watched it so many times that it warped. The VHS was just completely warped. I just, you know, we could quote bits to each other. And I just thought that was amazing that he was just a guy who went to a school near where I went to school. And he, you know, then went on to win Oscars. And so I suppose that was the first time I really thought, you know, this is what I want to do. Actually, I don't think I even really thought that then. I think it probably took me until I was in my 20s to really think about it, but it was just inspiring.
I mean, of your career, you've said, quote, "I knew I wanted to do something in film or TV, but I went in at the bottom making people's tea."
Yes.
How did you get your start writing, and what do you see as your first big significant accomplishment in that arena?
So, yeah, I did. I started, I remember it was almost the days before email. I wrote 100 letters to different companies, and one company got back to me and said, "Do you want to be a runner?" So I started off as a runner, and then I worked as a script editor. That my first sort of jump up was to be a script editor, which again I don't think you have in America, but is kind of working with writers and shaping the script basically. And I'd worked on a show called Where the Heart Is, which was a sort of medical drama. And then from there, yeah, that was my big break, really, I suppose, that was kind of the point where I started to go seeing what writers did and thinking, that looks really cool. That looks really cool. And you get to work from home in your pyjamas if you want to. So then I just worked on lots of different shows, big shows, like, well, big in terms of scale, in terms of the amount of people, EastEnders and The Bill and things like that. And then, yeah, just, and then it's people you meet along the way, really. I think that's how these things work. You just meet people with similar sensibilities, like Diedrich Santer, who has been a real champion of my career, really, and given me my big break, which was Grantchester. So it's all down to him, really.
And finally, what's next for you?
Oh, well, it's a very weird thing being a writer, because you kind of work, you kind of fill your head with one show, and then you think, oh no, what next? Exactly, what next? So I've got a few. I'm working a lot with Diedrich and Emma, the producers. We've got an idea that we're touting around at the moment, so top secret at the moment. But hopefully, if that comes off, we're kind of trying to get some interest in that. And then I start getting the fear basically around this time, like, I will never work again. But I think that's every writer. But hopefully something new and interesting, and set in the Civil War in UK in 1600s. So different, very
intriguing.
Different. Lots of swearing. Very unlike Grantchester. So,
well, fingers crossed.
Thank you.
Daisy Coulam, thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been lovely to chat.
We're taking a short break here on the podcast to prepare for another round of interviews, but be sure to subscribe to Masterpiece Studio on iTunes, Stitcher, and anywhere else you might find your podcasts so you can catch our upcoming conversations with the actors and talent behind Endeavor. On August 20th, young Detective Morse returns to Masterpiece as moody as ever.
How many papers went astray? You said a number. If there were any way to find out, I'd be interested to know.
Will Morse be able to distance himself from last season's shootout? Or will his search for Joan Thursday and his quest for a sergeant's title overwhelm him? We'll cover it all here on the podcast later this month. We say goodbye this week to longtime producer Rachel Aronoff, who leaves the Masterpiece Studio team for a new adventure in our nation's capital. We wish Rachel the very best of luck, and we'll miss her here at Masterpiece Studio. Her expert hand kept the ship steady at all times. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Elishaba Etoop is our editor. Special thanks to Barrett Brontis and Suzanne Simpson. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. I watch everything with subtitles on. Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.